Silence over eyes. Please be seated.
Yes, Ms. Hedge.
So before I call the next witness, could I deal with the documents that I
need
to tender? There is an index which I will tender as an exhibit, but can I just indicate some small amendments given some of those documentary difficulties we encountered in the opening? So for the parties who have this document, item 28 will have a new FSS number, and the description should be email from Alec McNevin to Amanda Reeves. There'll be a new 34A, which is FSS.0001.0067.6325, an email from Justin House to Alan McNevin, dated 12 May 2016. And number 51 now has a number WIT.0029.0005.0001. So what I propose, Commissioner, is that I give you this index, which has some handwritten amendments, at least as a placeholder. If you could give it an exhibit and then an exhibit number for the bundle of documents.
Yes. The list of documents to be tendered in relation to the sperm microscopy issue is Exhibit 90. The bundle of documents in relation to the sperm microscopy issue is Exhibit 91.
Thank you. And we'll replace that with a fully updated, clean index when we can.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next witness is by video link. It is Mr. Clint Cochrane, and I call Mr. Cochrane.
Yes. Mr. Cochrane, do you wish to take an oath or make an affirmation?
Affirmation, please.
Yes. You affirm that the evidence you shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Ms. Hedge?
Thank you. Can you see and hear me, Mr. Cochrane?
Yes, you're very small, but I can see you.
Thank you, I think. you are Clinton Mark Cochrane, is that right?
That's correct.
And you're the laboratory manager of forensic biology / DNA in New South Wales?
That's correct.
All right. You've provided a report to the commission dated 10 October 2022.
I did.
And can I have that brought up on the screen? EXP, thank you, .001.001. Do you see that there, Mr. Cochrane?
I do.
All right, that's the first page of your report?
It is.
Thank you. And there are two appendices to that report, the first being your curriculum vitae and the second being your instructions and index to brief?
Yeah, that's right.
All right, can we have a quick look at Appendix A, which is EXP.0004.0002.001. This sets out your qualifications that you've obtained?
Yes.
All right, and your current position?
It does, yes.
And you've held that position since 2018, so four to 5 years?
That's right.
All right. And moving over onto the second page of that document, sets out your, at the top of the page, if we can zoom in there, please, operator, sets out your previous relevant experience in forensic DNA?
Yes, that's right.
All right, so you've been working as a biologist in at one level or another in increasingly higher levels since 2002, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So 20 years in this field?
Yes, a little bit over.
And is it the case that you have had a particular research interest in sexual assault type casework, including the presentation of sexual assault investigation kit evidence? Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
All right. Thank you. Now, you were engaged by the Commission to deal with a topic that at least here we've been referring to a sperm microscopy?
Yes.
All right. And you were asked a number of questions about how the laboratory dealt with that issue that arose in late 2015 or early 2016. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Can I just take you to some particular parts of your report? Can we turn to page 5 of the main report, please, operator? And if we can expand on the bottom half of the page from the heading. Do you have your report with you, Mr. Cochrane?
I do.
You're welcome to refer to it if it's easier than the screen, whatever is easier for you.
Okay, thank you.
We see there the question that was asked, whether the method, system and process in relation to sperm detection, testing, analysis was consistent with international best practice when the issue arose in 2016. So this is before any actions were taken by the laboratory. And in paragraph 22, you conclude that they were in line with best practice, assuming that those processes were working.
Yes, that's right.
Is that right? Yeah. And is it your view that the particular instances of sperm being found on the ER, sperm not being found on the ER slides but found on the diff-lysis slide suggests that the process was not working?
I think it's the disparity between the sperm densities that we're seeing between the evidence recovery and the differential extraction slide that leads to the conclusion that it's not an optimal method used in the evidence recovery process to create that sperm microscopy slide.
I see. So is it the magnitude of the difference that was of particular import to you?
Yes, if they were very close, it could be just random occurrences or slight differences in dilution factors between the methods that could cause slight differences. It was the magnitude of differences between the two sperm microscopy readings that gave rise to the concerns about the evidence recovery process for creating sperm microscopy slides.
I see. And so the difference between, we've heard this morning a little about that semi-quantitative scale, but is the difference between 0 and 3+ a very big difference?
It's very big, yes.
Now, can we turn then to page 6 of the report? And in paragraph 24, you say that your opinion is that those multiple instances of sperm not being found in ER slides, but then in abundance on a differential slide, would warrant an OQI or an adverse event. And so does that relate to whether these issues could be simply variability within the lab or a systemic problem?
So the differences between the amount of sperm found between those times, it didn't just happen once. If it happened once, you could put it down to a one-off event. The fact that it was seen on multiple occasions and raised by multiple people within the laboratory over a period of time would suggest that there was something of a systemic nature in underperformance of the recovery process to make sperm microscope slides.
And what's the benefit of it being an OQI or an adverse event as opposed to not being recorded in those quality management tools?
The way that quality management usually occurs is you flag that there is an issue through a mechanism within the laboratory. So in Queensland, it appears that it's an OQI or an adverse event. Typically, you raise these notices, and from there, that leads you to an investigation in terms of what is working or not working in terms of the quality of that process.
All right, thank you. Now, can we turn then to paragraph 26 to 27? And this deals with the time period before which the workaround was implemented in August of 2016. You understand the time period I'm talking about?
I do, yes.
All right. And you identify in paragraph 26 that there was about 6 months between the issue being initially flagged and the initial project request, and then about 8 months between that initial issue being flagged and the workaround. And you say this meant that a suboptimal method was used for approximately 8 months after concerns were initially voiced.
That's
right. And in paragraph 27, you say that's an excessive period to initiate an investigation.
Yes, given those 3 points, A, B, and C below.
Yes. And what sort of time period would you have expected the workaround to be implemented within?
It's not only the time frame, it's the amount of times that it was flagged as a concern. It happened multiple occasions within a three-month period. So if there's an issue that's raised as a one-off event, then a wait-and-see approach is not typically that bad an idea with situations like that, depending on the significance of the event. The fact that it was happening on multiple occasions within a few months would suggest that it was probably to be seen as an issue of concern. Throughout that period, from 3 to 6 months, for instance, there was on multiple occasions emails also suggesting that the reporting biologists in particular were quite concerned about the matter and the consequence that some DNA samples might not be tested. So in that time frame, I would have expected probably 3 months as the outside limit. Especially when you started seeing multiple occasions being reported in a fairly short period of time.
Okay. And that workaround that was implemented on the 8th of August, that is for every case to look at the ER slide and the diplysis slide, is that an obvious workaround, or is that one that would have taken a lot of effort to consider?
That workaround was effectively part of their process already in their SOPs. So the evidence recovery slide is one opportunity to create a slide. The differential lysis, which is when a sample goes through for testing specifically for semen, extraction method for semen, is another opportunity to make that. So that was already an option to be made within the process prior to that fix being put in place. Effectively, what it meant was that it was being done as a routine on all samples suspected of containing semen, regardless of what the sample is. So I would have said that was a fairly logical step if you were unsure about the adequateness of the evidence recovery process to make slides.
I see. And so did you see any reason, or can you think of any reason why that wasn't done in, say, March of 2016 when the email came from Ms. Wilson indicating a further example?
Not in particular. I can't see any great reason.
All right. Now, you're saying paragraph 28, that workflow modification largely resolved the sperm microscopy issue, ensuring that samples containing sperm progressed as required. But then project 181 continued. And so do we take from that project 181 looked at a much wider range of issues than the particular sperm microscopy issue that had been raised in late 2015, early 2016?
Project 181 went through a number of different phases. I think there were 7 parts from my report. Originally, it was looked at that they were looking at the effectiveness of the evidence recovery slide process, followed by trying to make a change or to check out a different option for the evidence recovery slide process. From that point onwards, they largely made the decision to move towards the slide preparation in the differential extraction part. And from that point onwards, they were really trying to move towards the differential slide as the port of call but also to modify the evidence recovery process to maintain the ability to do presumptive testing in retrospect as well.
Okay. And so Project 181 did not identify a root cause of the problem that was identified. Is that right?
I think that there wasn't... it was acknowledged that the evidence recovery slide was not creating sperm density readings in line with either the DNA results or the differential slide readings. So I think that they quite quickly came to the conclusion about the issue was in some way in the evidence recovery preparation. They ruled out that it was a personnel issue where the staff were unable to visualise sperm under a microscope. So really it was around about the creation of the evidence recovery slide. So they in effect did come to the cause of the issue being the preparation of the evidence recovery slide. They probably didn't go to a further sub-step of why that wasn't working, apart from noticing that it wasn't working prior to and also in the first stage of that Project 181.
I see. All right. Can we move forward then to paragraph 47 and 48, which appears on page 9? And here you deal with a data analysis that was performed to look at samples that may have been affected by this inadequate process. Sorry, operator 47 and 48. Page 9, not at all. So you identify there that there was a data analysis of samples between 8th of August 2016 and the 28th of March 2017. Do you see that?
I do.
All right. And 147 of those 738, there was a difference between there was no sperm on the ER slide and some sperm at least on the differential slide. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right, now can we go through paragraph 48 together? Of those 147, A, 71 would have been tested anyway due to other sorts of results.
That's right.
All right, can we turn on to the next page and look at B? Yes, thank you. B, 47 samples would have progressed through DNA testing using the routine CELLS protocol. Can you explain what the CELLS protocol is?
So I'll probably start with the differential protocol is basically trying to separate sperm cells from the remainder of the DNA. In terms of the cells protocol, that would be their routine extraction protocol that's used that is not performing the differential component, trying to separate any cellular components. Effectively, it's extracting DNA from any potential cells that are in that sample, as opposed to a component of the cells.
Okay, and you say that that method may be less effective for internal swabs. Can you just explain to us why that would be?
For an internal swab, typically internal swabs are highly cellular dense areas. So any competing, if you're trying to find the DNA of a foreign person, so not the person who owns the body cavity, they're in competition with the person's own cells to try to find the other person's DNA. So effectively, the person's own body might swamp the DNA profile, making it so you wouldn't be able to visualize the component of DNA from a different person than the person whose body cavity it is.
All right. And how much less effective is it than the differential lysis process?
For sperm, are you talking about there?
Yes.
Okay. For sperm, it's very effective to be able to separate the sperm cells. So effectively, it renders the background material irrelevant and you're targeting the component of the DNA that you're interested in. So in terms of not performing that differential lysis component, if sperm is available, what it means is that you may be unable to pick up the the profile of the unknown person or the person who it's not their body. In terms of how much of a concern this would be heavily based on the area that the sample was taken from and also the material that the external person could have left as well.
Okay. So can you give a generalized, is it much less effective or just a little less effective, or what's your view?
If you've got a significant amount of sperm, you're better off using a differential lysis because you're much more likely to get a probative result.
Okay. Then in C, you have 29 samples would not have been DNA tested, and of those, 28 would not have recovered new evidential DNA profiles, and one would have recovered a new DNA evidence. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. And so in paragraph 49, you conclude, and I understand the Queensland lab also concluded, that only one of 738 samples would have been heavily affected. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. But just going back to, I'm sorry?
If it was using the previous workflow, it would have been affected, yes.
I see. Can we just go back to 48 and have B and C on the screen? Could I just ask you about these? Given that the cells protocol is less effective than the differential lysis process, is it right that perhaps some of those 47 samples would also have been affected by the previous workflow because sperm would not have been detected when it was in fact present?
Yes. It also probably would mean that if it was used through the other method with cells, it may be that you could not define the cellular component as being from semen as well, which may have evidential value.
Okay. And of the 28 in paragraph CI, the way that was calculated is whether there was a new evidential DNA profile, i.e. a new person who hadn't been identified from some other swab. Is that right?
Yes. So these 28 samples would not have been tested previously, but when they were tested, there was other results within the sexual assault investigation kit that would have obtained the same information. Or the DNA results were unsuccessful and non-comparable.
I see. And when you say the same information, do you mean the same identification of a person?
Yes. So I'll use the vaginal cavity, for example. If you took multiple samples from the internal vaginal cavity, if you find a DNA result from the endocervical swab, for instance, that is still indicative of the pretty much the internal vaginal cavity. So finding the same profile on the endocervical swab, the high vaginal swab, the low vaginal swab would not give you any additional information that just one of those samples would have provided.
All right, I understand. Is it the case, though, that there could be a case where a sample would give extra information, for example, if the allegation was ejaculation onto a hand or onto the back, and that's the one that was missed, that swab, then the fact that that same person's spermatozoa was on the high vaginal swab would actually give extra information?
Yes. I'm not sure that the question Cochrane can answer better than anybody else who's familiar with criminal trials.
All right. Well, perhaps I should ask it in this way. That example I just gave, that would have fallen within the way they did the data analysis, would have fallen within the 28. That wouldn't have made its way into the number one.
Yes, I believe so.
All right. So is it fair to say then that taking into account those examples we've just done, at least one sample would have been heavily affected. That's the one in paragraph Roman 2. But there may be others that would have been heavily affected depending on the particular case.
Definitively one. The other ones there potentially could be more, yes.
Thank you. Can we go back then to paragraph 36 of your report? And this is where you deal with whether or whether there's an opportunity for retesting of these samples. And I'm sorry, before we go on, sorry, we can put 36 up, please, from both pages if possible. But what the Queensland lab did, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Cochrane, is did that data analysis after the workflow had been put into place and drew from that conclusions about what might have been happening before the workflow was in place, the workaround.
Yes, the data analysis was from the period, it was roughly 9 months following the introduction of both the evidence recovery and the differential lysis slide both being examined. So it was basically a concurrent test of those first 9 months to see what the believed effect would be if they did a retrospective analysis of other casework.
All right. And was there a conclusion? I'm sorry, was that data analysis done as part of Project 181 or was it separate?
I believe it was separate.
All right. And was there a conclusion drawn because of those statistics, that is the one out of 738, that they wouldn't do any other reconsideration of the previous samples?
I believe so, yes.
All right. All right. So here at paragraph 36, you deal with the opportunity to consider retesting.
Okay.
And you say that there should be some case-by-case analysis of whether there was other evidentiary results or whether there's been a conclusion to the case. Is that right?
Yes.
And that would narrow the number of cases that might benefit from retesting. Is that right?
That's correct.
And you suggest that should be done in with consultation or with information sharing with police and courts, potentially defence lawyers as well?
Yes. I'm doing this on the basis that an example would be if a sexual assault allegation, if the consent, for instance, was the area of concern, the DNA evidence is unlikely to provide evidential results one way or another. So I think that you could limit the amount of retesting that would be required for these cases.
All right. And in paragraph 37, you recommend, or you say that they should, the Queensland Lab should perform a data analysis to identify cases fitting those criteria so that they can then determine how big this task would be of checking what might have been missed.
If it's practical. So it comes down to this is a while ago, and obviously limbs do make a difference of how practical it is to be able to do this. Given the previous data analysis that we have been talking about, it is believed that the amount of samples that could be affected would be minimal with this case. So if you could make a easily identifiable way to be able to extract these data, and there really shouldn't be that many cases that it applies to, and the testing would be quite minimal, you would anticipate in this circumstance.
All right.
Do I understand you to mean that you can get a list of cases that underwent the process, and you can then get a list from police of cases that have been finalised in one way or another, so you can exclude all of those as your first step, for example, and then you can take other steps to exclude other cases, and that would leave you with a much smaller class of cases that would warrant thinking about further, and of those, maybe even if you consider the criteria for selection, for retesting or for testing, then you'll end up with a manageable, you'd expect that you'd end up with a manageable number of samples that would require retesting, not hundreds.
Yes, that's right. So if you had a way to easily identify the samples through a LIMS system, that would meet the criteria that I have put elsewhere in this my report, then I would expect that the amount of rework that would need to be done on these samples would be quite minimal.
If this error had arisen in your laboratory, is that what you would direct be done?
In 2016, that's probably, I would do that, because our LIMS would cater for us to be able to do this search.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Can I turn to a different topic now? Oh, I'm sorry. The last thing I should say on that topic is that your view is that some of these samples might benefit from YSTR testing.
Yes. I'd say that just broadly, sexual assault investigation of cases that haven't had prior YSTR testing, there is a potential avenue for investigation, whether it's within this data set or other data sets. So it is just a way that you can retrospectively test samples further.
And is the YSTR method a more effective method than the differential lysis and sperm microscopy method?
They're done for slightly different purposes. So the ideal situation would be that you would have a sperm microscopy method that was robust and gave you the results that you wanted. You do the differential extraction on the samples that had sperm for these circumstances. And for things that didn't have sperm, you could put in for YSTR testing instead. To do a YSTR test, you can do that on the epithelial fraction in the differential extraction, but the differential extraction is quite a inefficient method where there is considerable cellular loss during the method. So there are methods that are extraction methods that are better if you are going to use a YSTR analysis instead of the differential extraction.
Okay, and is just taking a step back in how the process works, is it right that using the suspension method, you obtain a sample that has all the cells, sperm and other epithelial cells and so on, all together in the suspension, and then when you do differential lysis, that changes that whole solution into just having the sperm? Is that right?
It changes it into two components. It changes it into the sperm cell component and then the epithelial fraction component. So it's effectively removing sperm from the remainder of what is in that sample.
Right.
A small thing, that is what Queensland, the QHFSS did in terms of the suspension method. The suspension method isn't what is performed at FAS in New South Wales.
You have the YSTR process in place, is that right?
That's correct.
When did you implement that?
The first time we implemented YSTRs was using YFiler in 2009. Subsequently, I believe it was 2018 or 2019 that we implemented YFiler Plus, which is a updated YSTR kit.
So you began using the process in its then current form in 2009.
That's right.
Does it take a great deal of trouble and expense to validate it and implement it?
I would say any amplification kit has its problems in validation and implementation that you have to overcome. With a thorough process to do the validation and perform any troubleshooting that comes along. But any time that you put in an amplification kit, the laboratories are well placed to overcome those obstacles.
And how long were you at the lab in 2009 when the first system was instituted?
Yes, I started in 2002.
And can you recall how long it took to validate and implement the system in 2009?
No would be the short answer.
All right, thanks very much.
How about 2018, 2019 when you validated YFiler Plus?
It would have taken months.
Months, did you say?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And so I'm sorry to take you back to the suspension method, but I just want to confirm, once you've done differential lysis, you don't retain any part of that mixed solution that had both the epithelial and the sperm in it? Is that right?
They're split into different components. If the differential extraction works as it's designed, and it's not a foolproof process, the idea is that you separate the sperm fraction from the epithelial fraction as far as possible.
So and without retaining tubes. Some part, I'm sorry.
They go into separate tubes.
All right. So there's no retention of any part of that initial suspension?
Depending on laboratory policy would be depending if they keep the original substrate in a basket.
Okay. What I'm seeking to ask is, perhaps I'll just ask it more directly, is are you on the back foot or are you starting from behind, having already done differential lysis to then send these samples to ISTR? Are you in a worse position than if you just sent them to ISTR at the start?
If you did a YSTR, the best way to get a DNA profile for YSTRs would be to use the cell method, the routine extraction protocol, not a differential lysis. Differential lysis is designed to try to get the sperm fraction specifically, but as I said, it's a very inefficient method where there is considerable cell loss along the process. So All right. You are better off doing a routine cell lysis to be able to get a maximal amount for YSTR testing.
All right, thank you. Can we turn to paragraph 56, please, which is on page 11? And here you conclude that by 2020, utilising YSTR testing in sexual assault investigations is considered best practice?
It is. There is no such thing as a designated best practice. There's two options that are considered acceptably good practice. The first would be to be able to create evidence recovery slides that are reliable and produce the results that are expected, and then go through and choose whether to do differential extraction or a routine lysis, depending on which DNA typing kit you want to use. The other option that is recommended in the United States, for instance, is what they call a direct-to-DNA process, where effectively all samples are put through for DNA and they use the Y quantitation as a screening tool to determine what DNA typing kit to use. So both of those methods are in place for different purposes. The directed DNA method would be considered appropriate for areas that are especially backlogged in their sexual assault investigations. Other laboratories could potentially take the first option for a more nuanced approach to be able to determine which way they want to proceed with their evidence. So I think either option can be chosen and would be considered best practice. Comes down to the resources you have available, the time that you have available to do things, and what tools are at your command. Exclusively doing differential extractions throughout the piece, though, for instance, would limit your chances of being able to obtain YSTR profiles from those samples, especially ones that don't have sperm,
So if you put aside time, resource, backlog considerations, resourcing considerations. Is there a scientific best practice putting aside those things?
Both of those methods that I said are best practice. So in terms of if you can get reproducible results in your sperm microscopy, either by the doctors who are collecting the sexual assault kits, creating slides, or the evidence recovery team using a method that actually is effective, I think that the first method is actually better because then you can choose which extraction method you want to use to determine what is the most effective way to recover the DNA type that you are wishing to target. So if sperm is available, You'll potentially do the differential extraction as your predominant test because you are trying to remove the female from that. If you don't have the ability to do the differential extraction because there is no sperm present, then you're better off maximizing the amount of DNA present in the sample to target for YSTR testing. YSTR testing isn't as discriminatory between individual. It is to a familial, a paternal line. So for instance, my father, myself and my son would all have the same YSTR profile. So there are limitations that that YSTRs give. What it does give you an opportunity to do if you use YSTRs though, is to recover DNA profiles that you wouldn't see because the internal swabs, DNA that are contained within those internal swabs are probably swamping whatever remnant DNA is left from a potential sexual offender.
Okay, so I'll try to summarise this. The two best practice methods, one is a reliable evidence recovery slide production and one is direct to DNA.
I would say that one, it could be evidence recovery or it could be prior to that. So the slide is made at the hospital as opposed to in the evidence recovery process.
All right. So a reliable slide making process right at the start or direct to DNA?
Yes, they're two acceptable methods depending on what you're trying to find.
And neither of them are currently in place at the Queensland lab?
No.
I know you're agreeing that neither of them are in place, just to be neither just to
of
confirm.
Them. Yeah, neither of them are in place. If you were to, it would be closer to the second model, but it's not a like-for-like comparison.
I see. And so the difference, so YSTR and differential lysis are two potential secondary steps once you've got that reliable slide-making capacity. That's what you've explained, is that right?
That's right.
All right. So the problem with the current process is that they don't have that reliable slide-making capacity either at the hospital or in evidence recovery.
Yes. So the only reliable method they had demonstrated in the laboratory was the differential slide.
All right. Thank you. Finally, can we deal with the report given to ESR, which is paragraph 51 to 54? On page 10, and you reviewed the material given to ESR?
I did.
And your conclusion in paragraph 54 is that on the material you obtained or you were given, briefed with by the Commission, ESR were not specifically tasked with assessing the microscopy issue, its cause or its potential solutions. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. If I can draw your attention to 51, the apparent only reference to this issue was the quote, an issue has been raised specifically regarding spermatozoa negative acid phosphatase negative sexual assault samples. However, a review of the processing of the SAGs would be appreciated in the spirit of continuing quality improvement. That appeared to be the only reference to the sperm microscopy issue that we've been discussing.
Thank you. Thank you. Those are my questions.
Thank you.
We have no questions. Thank you.
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Cochran, I just wanted to get you to clarify, if you would, some aspects of the workflows that you refer to in paragraphs 20 and 21 of your statement. Perhaps if we bring that up and you can refresh your memory about what you've said.
Thank you.
It's page 5 of the report, please, Mr. Operator. Paragraph 20 deals with workflows that you identified as being in place from September 2010, am I right?
Could we scan in on that? I'm looking on a fairly small computer.
Sure. If you'd enlarge paragraphs 20 and also 21, if you would, Mr. Operator.
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
I was just drawing your attention to paragraph 20. Is it right that you describe there the workflows as you identified them as being in place in September 2010?
Yes, that's the document that I referred to with that.
Okay.
That method.
And that's SOP number 17189 version 10, correct?
That's correct.
All right. I'd just like to show you a portion of that. Mr. Operator, the document is FSS.0001.0052.7882. That's the facing page. Can you see that, Mr. Cochrane?
Yes.
All right. Now, could I ask you to go, Mr. Operator, to page .7894? I just wanted to ask you, it appears that that is a representation in diagrammatic form of what you have described within paragraph 20.
Yes.
Can you tell us whether
that appears?
That's correct?
It's yes.
And in paragraph 20, you've set out subparagraphs A, B, and C. That they are represented on this diagram by the three boxes, one containing the words internal swabs on the one hand, secondly, external swabs, and thirdly, DNA DLYS. Do they represent those three options?
Yes, also 20AI was the DNA D-lies.
Correct, and that's the one, the DNA DLYS on the top or towards the top left of the diagram, correct?
Yes, so the four boxes would be A, B, and C, the content.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Well, in paragraph 21, if we go back to the report, you refer to another SOP there being 32106 version 3. You note in the last sentence that that SOP details how the case context may modify the laboratory progression, correct?
That's right.
I'd just like to explore the way in which that is so. Mr. Operator, could you bring up document WIT.0044.0007.0001. Perhaps, Mr. Operator, if you go to the bottom left-hand corner where the document ID resides and just allow Mr. Cochrane to see that.
Yes.
That's the document you're referring to at paragraph 21, am I right?
That's correct.
All right. Could I go firstly to page 6 where there's an amendment history? Could you enlarge the amendment history, Mr. Operator? Now, you know how these things work. When a version is updated, the update goes into the amendment history and you see as against the amendment, what is the nature of the amendment in the case of each version, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Is it right then to conclude that this SOP first commenced operation on 23 October 2013?
Yes.
And we can see the nature of the second and third, or the amendments to the second and third versions in the final column, correct?
That's right.
Right. Now, if we go from there to page 7 to a diagram, does this diagram then represent the applicable workflow apparently commencing with version 1 in October 2013?
That appears so, yes.
Just to be fair, Mr. Operator, if you'd go above the diagram to the introductory heading and the wording, this diagram relates to SAKE examination workflow, which, correct me if I'm wrong, was the same workflow as you described in paragraph 20 of your report.
Yes, that's right.
So this is a more recent and more perhaps more updated version of the workflow from that which you described in paragraph 20?
If you pull up the workflow diagram in its whole, it's effectively, if you say microscopy down in that workflow, it is pretty similar. It's the same from that point, obviously just not particularly. They're using exam strategy instead of other options that are available, but it does appear to be a more updated version, taking into account exam strategy as well.
Yeah, well, what I was going to suggest is that this appears to introduce for the first time, and you can tell me if I'm right, this appears to introduce for the first time the concept of examination strategy.
Yes.
Okay. And to understand that, Mr. Operator, can we go back to the first page? Uh, 4.1, the paragraph examination strategies. This is what appears to be new, am I right, with this workflow? The concept of development of a workflow strategy for all sakes?
That does seem to be the context of this case above and beyond what just the sperm microscopy. Sexual assault cases don't just rely or relate to just microscopy in itself. So I think that the method that is being put up really is going through what you would do if you received a sexual assault investigation.
I see. So the concept is wider than microscopy.
Yes, it's wider than just safe kits as well. It's
okay, understand.
More inclusive.
Yep. But if we go back to the diagram at page 7, we see towards the bottom right of the diagram two boxes with the words exam strategy. Do I interpret that correctly, that in the event of negative microscopy and negative presumptive testing, this introduces a further layer to the process by way of recourse to the examination strategy once those screening tests have been concluded?
Yes, it does give an avenue to determine what is further using an exam strategy. I do believe...
I believe that
further on in this document, it talks about specific scenarios where exam strategy would be used.
Right. It's a form of discretion, is it not, to the scientist to determine what ought to be done in the context of all of the case history and all information known, irrespective of the fact that all screening may in fact be negative?
Yes.
And is it right to say that that further discretionary step is an additional form of risk mitigation for missing evidence, even where all screening is negative?
Potentially, yes. It depends on how it would be used.
Right. Well, as you say, we don't need to go to it, but there are guidelines within the document as to what matters may be relevant to that. I'm wondering then if you could tell me this, given that from October 2013 there appears to be this additional discretionary element to the processing of SAKE samples, allowing a scientist to make a decision about that even if all screening is negative, whether that in turn feeds into the size of the problem created by the inadequate process pertaining to the ER slide. You see where I'm getting at?
No, sorry, I didn't follow.
Well, do you accept that the examination strategy provided for in this document is an additional form of risk mitigation against missing cogent evidence?
It allows a biologist some options to be able to perform further testing potentially?
It didn't answer me directly. Is it a form of mitigation of risk of missing evidence?
I think, yes, potentially. Once again, it would be how the exam strategy is used. If the exam strategy in a certain scenario was no further testing, it wouldn't mitigate the risk potentially, or potentially it could send you down a pathway where other things may be missed. So it really depends on what is taken up with the exam strategy. By having it there, it does give options for people to do certain testing on there. So it potentially could be a risk mitigation strategy. It depends on how it's used.
Right. You acknowledge, though, that at the very least, that is a form of discretion which apparently didn't exist according to the workflow diagram we looked at for 2010.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Cochran. By the way, Commissioner, that document doesn't appear to be on Council's tender list, so I'd propose to tender.
Yes, and it is current from what date, Mr. Rice?
Well, version 3 is current from 29 January 2015.
2015. Document, tell me if I've got it right, document 0044-0007-0007, document WIT 0044-0007-0007 is Exhibit 92.
It's actually 0001, I think, Commissioner.
Oh, 0001, of course. 0044-0007-0001 is Exhibit 92.
Thank you.
Now, does anybody else want to ask Mr. Cochran any questions, Mr. Deem?
No.
No?
No, thank you, Commissioner.
No? Ms. Hedge, do you have any re-examination?
No, I don't.
No?
There's also Ms. Freeman here for Mr. McNevin.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Thank you, Commissioner. I seek leave to appear on behalf of Mr. McNevin. We don't have any questions.
Yeah, sorry, what was your name?
Freeman.
Freeman. Thank you, Ms. Freeman. You have leave.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I don't have any re-examination. Might Mr. Cochran be
yes. excused? Thank you. Mr. Cochran, for your assistance and for the work on your report, and you're free to cut the link if you wish.
Thank you.
Yes, Ms. Hedge, where do we go next?
The next witness is Mr. Alan McNevin. I wonder, given the time, whether we might break now for lunch and perhaps resume at 2 o'clock or at 2:15.
Yes, well, why don't we... well, let's adjourn till 2:15.
Yes, there's no rush, I don't.
All right.